If you're in an organisation and your technical leadership is not encouraging these kinds of practices and your team is not interested, I think you're going to really struggle to lead it from where you are in a team. So in that situation, I would be tempted to look for a new job, really. There has to be a level of technical leadership in the organisation to encourage this, I think.
From Tuple, this is Distributed, where we show how world-class engineers and their teams tackle the challenges of remote work. I'm Jack Hanna, your host. Hey, everyone. Today, we're talking with Emily Baich, who's a software engineer, author, technical coach, and the creator of Saman Coaching, a technical coaching practice that's widely adopted across the globe. Emily is well-known for her keynote addresses, expertise in software development practices, and has over 25 years of experience writing code. In today's conversation, we're going to dive into her personal background, stories of high-performing teams, as well as touch on how to actually change your software practices driven from her wealth of coaching experience. So Emily, we're psyched to have you on.
Happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, of course. Emily, I like to start these things with a story. You're well known, as I mentioned, for your point of view on software development practices and engineering excellence for that matter. And I know a lot of this for you came from extreme programming. And so I want to better understand the origin story. When were you first exposed to extreme programming?
I was first exposed to it when I joined a new project back in early 2000. This was a greenfield project. It was a startup. This was the dot-com boom time. So we were building a fresh new project, cutting-edge technology, really good people. And one of the guys in the team turned up and he handed everyone a copy of Extreme Programming Explained by Kent Beck and said, I want to try out XP on this project. Said, okay. And I read the book and I was like, this sounds really cool. And so we tried to do as much of it as we could on this project. I had such a good time. But then, of course, the dot-com crash happened and the project ran out of money and everyone was disbanded. And you know, the project itself was not successful, but I learned so much from that. So it all comes from that era that I was really quite an early adopter of extreme programming and the associated practices.
When you first got started with those practices, what was the hardest part about trying this totally different way of working?
With that first team, everyone was on board with trying it out. The hard part came when that team disbanded and I got to the next team and like I came in with all my enthusiasm and my like unit tests and everyone there was just like completely uninterested. It was a really difficult experience because they hardly spoke to me and I was quite young, you know, and they just basically dismissed me and my ideas. My experience is probably not at all typical, but, you know, having discovered that this was such a good way to work, then my big problem was how to get other people on board with this. And that was the genesis, basically, of my whole coaching career, that there's one thing to realize that this stuff works and have experienced it working, but it's another thing to come into a project which already got established practices and to get them to realize that there's a better way to work.
I do think that is the hardest part. So I'm not sure that your experience is unrepresentative of anybody else's who's interested in trying these practices, because the practices themselves, obviously doing them well is hard and a skill in and of itself. But when you have buy-in, when folks are excited to try something new, humans are amazing people. They figure it out over time, right? The question is just how do you get them to start and sustain it long enough to start seeing progress? And so I think we're going to talk a decent amount about that today. But before we do, I've heard you say in another talk that TDD in particular really transformed the way that you think about writing code. Why did test-driven development have such a significant impact on you?
So test-driven development is an approach to developing software that got test in the name. So people kind of get hung up on, oh, it's about writing tests. But really, it's about incremental software development. It's about dividing a problem into small pieces and developing it piece by piece and confirming that that piece is working by having a test that passes instead of a more ad hoc approach, which was what I was doing before, was that I'd have all the pieces and I'd spend quite a long time kind of shuffling around bits of code and eventually everything would fall into place. TDD is so much more of a constantly making progress kind of activity. And it made me feel that I was making progress. I was building high quality code and I could go home and sleep well at night because I was leaving a suite of passing tests behind that I could pick up the next time.
I love that description. And I think that end psychological state is certainly one worth striving for, feeling like you can go home feeling good about the work that you did that day, sleep well at night. Obviously, since then, the early 2000s, when you were first exposed to these practices, had an amazing experience using them, and then started your coaching experience trying to figure out the best ways to introduce these practices to different teams. What have you been up to for the last 5 years or so to sort of contextualize your point of view further?
Yeah, well, I've been a full-time technical coach and more recently YouTuber and general kind of communicator about how to adopt good engineering practices. So yeah, so I go in as a consultant, work with teams to help them to improve technical skills and adopt new practices. And then I write and speak and make videos about that too.
That's awesome. Do you want to define technical coaching specifically for a moment? Because I do think that sometimes folks get confused about what is a technical coach versus an agile coach or something else for that matter. So do you mind just defining that for us?
Absolutely. So it comes from agile coaching. The agile coach way of working, you need to teach, you need to mentor, you need to facilitate, and you need to ask all the right questions to help people change behavior. That is what I'm doing. I'm coaching. But instead of a lot of agile coaches are working with processes and how to understand requirements and get the organization working in a good way, my focus is entirely on software developers and how the development work happens. When I'm on the job, I'm doing a lot of mentoring and facilitating and teaching. But all of the content of that is about, well, how do we write unit tests? How do we refactor? How do we adopt continuous integration? All of those technical practices that developers need to do in order to be successful.
One of the other reasons I was excited for this conversation is because I know you have such a breadth of experience working with different teams, different companies, and in different contexts. And I think really understanding excellence in software engineering is hard to do, and in particular, getting folks to sort of adopt these practices and these mindsets behind them. I want to talk about a few stories, if you don't mind sharing. Could you tell me a little bit about one of the higher performing or highest performing teams that you've ever been exposed to, maybe setting the stage with some context of how you're involved and what made them high performing?
I'm thinking of a team that I joined because I knew of their reputation as being technically brilliant. There was one guy who I knew of his work, and I thought I'd like to work with him. I joined this team, and they were a group of like architects within an organization. So we were like four or five people who really saw our role as making the rest of all the developers productive. And the organization was going through a technical shift from a monolithic, large monolithic J2E Java thing to a microservices architecture with Scala. And this architecture team, they were really ahead of the curve. So individually, they were all brilliant technically, brilliant engineers, and really well up to date, reading widely. They knew a huge amount about software engineering and how to do it well. And we kind of set up this environment where we had continuous delivery and we had a lot of tool support and pipelines and cloud and all kinds of stuff. And it felt like we were creating a very productive environment for all the developers in that organization. But at the same time, as a team, we were very much operating as individuals. We each had our own area. I was focused on the build pipeline and the automated testing infrastructure. And one of the other guys was more onto the how do we deploy, how do we do rollback, how do we set up so that you can run the code locally and in the cloud in the same kind of way. And, you know, so we each had our kind of specialist area in order to create this high-performing engineering organization.
Well, and that runs in contrast to, I think, what Kent Beck and Martin Fowler and the extreme programming devotees would advocate for. And so it's interesting to hear you both be steeped in those practices and have this team come to mind. So square that circle for me. What was it about that team that allowed them to perform so well, despite the fact that as a team, folks were really sort of siloed off and working as individuals, as opposed to collaborating deeply and doing the work together?
We did obviously talk to each other to an extent. It's just that the collaboration was at the level of, I'm doing this piece and I think it fits in with your piece. And I'm talking to this team about their problems with this piece. And we weren't sitting down and coding together. We weren't pair programming, which is something that I kind of find surprising looking back on it, because usually you get better ideas when you work together. But somehow we didn't do that in that team, and yet it worked. I'm not sure I can really explain why.
I do think some folks will listen to this and say, aha, gotcha. Herein is the issue. Even the people who reclaim pair programming and ensemble programming is a preferred or better way of working, even their best experiences are experiences working individually. And so I am curious, what was it about the way that that team worked or the individuals on that team worked that allowed you to be so successful?
You're really pushing me now, because I have had brilliant experiences. Like in that first team I mentioned, we did lots and lots of pair programming, and that really was helpful. I guess one of the differences could be that because we were all really senior, maybe we would have been even more effective if we had pair program. But at the time, it felt like we each had our own specializations and we complemented each other without directly collaborating on the work.
I do think that that speaks to some of the doctrines in the Agile Manifesto, which is that each team should be left to uncover the best practices for them in their context.
Part of it also was just that we were almost like internal consultants. As a technical coach now, I come in as an outside consultant and I'm solving one part of the problem. And I'm collaborating with the people I'm coaching and then pairing with them. So in a way, we weren't kind of a team. We were a group of internal consultants, each with our specializations. And the people we really needed to collaborate with were our customers, the development teams, the people who were using the tools that we were creating. I spent a lot more time interacting with them than the other people in my ostensible team, I guess. That maybe explains it better, that the collaboration was happening, but it was not between us. It was between us and our customers.
So we've talked a little bit about what excellence looks like. I want to talk a little bit about change, because as we previewed earlier, one of the hardest parts isn't just understanding what great looks like, but instead understanding how to nudge a team who maybe isn't in that great zone towards better. Could you share a story of a team that you worked with where they actually were successfully able to undergo a somewhat significant change in the way that they worked?
The way I work with teams is I'm always looking to help them on two main fronts. There is the skills that you need to do something like test-driven development or to refactor safely. And there is the culture in the team that you need in order for those practices to flourish. And neither of those things happen overnight. So when we're talking about change, you've got to kind of take the long view, and I'm only there coaching the team for a part of that journey. Change happens very quickly when there's a crisis. But if there's a crisis and people can be prepared to take on something new, usually when I come in, there's not a crisis. They don't bring me in for a crisis. They bring me in because things have been going a bit badly for a long time and they need to just push things a bit more in the direction of higher code quality, less technical debt, more unit tests. And I can come in and kind of give a shove in the right direction. And then after I've stayed with the team for a few weeks or months, I can go on somewhere else. So I don't really get to see a huge change happen in the time I'm with a team. The biggest changes I normally see working with a team is that they start to have a new interest in quality for unit tests and in refactoring, and a renewed desire to work together and collaborate. So when I've checked in with teams after I've coached them, you know, months or years afterwards, what has actually stuck has been some of the technical practices, but a lot of the teamwork aspects. You know, they'll still be doing ensemble sessions when they find it appropriate.
Well, so how do you go about facilitating that sort of mindset shift? Because that's what it really sounds like. It sounds like the lasting impact that you try to impart or often see imparted is this psychological mindset shift in folks having an interest in these practices and feeling like they have the tools necessary to go out and refine their skills further. So where do you start? Let's imagine you're a developer, you're on a team who's in that situation and you aren't in a position where you can just hire you, right? Like, where would you recommend that a developer start in sort of nudging their team towards better?
It is hard from within a team, but even from within a team, there is things you can do. And this is what I was doing before I became a full-time coach. It was things like setting up a regular coding dojo or team learning session where you try and get people away from the production code and get into a fun little problem, a code carter, some piece of code that is purely for learning from, and to try and get people to code collaboratively on that. You know, if you can get an hour or a couple of hours once a month or once a week, whatever you can manage, and get people to actually come in and talk about, okay, we've got this code. Can we write it with, can we solve this problem with test-driven development? Can we refactor this code? Can we talk about those changes that we're making? And because it's not code that any of us really have a stake in for the long term, maybe we have better discussions than we do about our production code. And maybe we can learn better ways to interact and talk about code. And then maybe when we get back to the production code, then it's more likely that it would come up, oh, I think we could write a unit test. I think I remember how to do that. Or, you know, I think we could refactor this. Oh, that, what was that shortcut we used in the session, you know?
What I heard you say is, like, start with setting up a practice where you can apply some of these learnings or practice some of these learnings on non-production code. And you described it as a learning hour. How often would you do this type of thing? And what exactly would the setup be? Let's get tactical here for a second.
Tactical, yeah. Well, it's at some level, your time is not your own. You've got to get agreement from your managers and bosses and whoever that it's okay that you spend some of your work time on learning activities. You may have a training budget and you can say, oh, we'll spend our training budget on, we want to buy a book or watch a video, and then we want to sit and write some code together. So at some level, it's got to be in the kind of development budget that you've got some time for professional development and try and get some of that. And I would hope that it wouldn't be unreasonable that you could get an hour a week. When I was doing this, I found that my employer wasn't even really willing to consider even that. I learned a lot in user groups, evenings, code retreats, the weekends, these activities that you would do to go and practice on code carters. And that was incredibly valuable for me. But my hope is that in today's day and age, you don't need to sacrifice your weekends and your evenings, that your employer has an interest in you keeping up to date with your skills and investing in professional development. So try and get some of that time on work time.
Okay, so best case scenario, you're in a company that has some sort of budget or interest in developing you as engineers, and you get buy-in from your manager or whomever is necessary to use that money, to use those resources, to buy a book, buy a course that's related, and then set up a weekly hour-long session where you sort of discuss what you're learning in that book, and again, maybe start trying to apply some of those practices to non-production code. And the bit about non-production code that you highlighted before was that because it's non-production, folks don't have any sort of stake in the matter, which hopefully makes it a safer space to discuss the stuff and try the stuff. And if you don't live in that situation, as you didn't in many cases, it does sound like there's a wealth of resources that you can pursue sort of outside of work, in code retreats, in user groups. Do you have any that you specifically recommend for folks to check out that we could link to?
I run the SAMAN Technical Coaching Society, which we have a monthly open space discussion where you can meet other technical coaches and people interested in how to learn better practices, so which is free to attend. It's not quite what I was talking about, but we also, if you get involved in the community, we do run these kind of meetings for practicing and learning skills. So you can get involved there. There's also public, so like open source development. So some open source tools have a regular online ensemble that you can join and you work on developing that open source tool. I'm thinking of the one that for approval tests for Python, I know they have a regular ensemble that people can join, things like that.
Yeah, and that's run by Llewellyn Falco, I think.
Right? It is, yeah.
On weekends. Yeah. No, I've talked to him about it. And a couple of folks from Tubal have actually joined to sort of get a better understanding, you know, learn from him and how some of this stuff works. So that's cool. Yeah, we can link to some of that in the show notes. You shared some tactical tips on if folks are on a team where you want to try this stuff and there's already some level of buy-in from everybody else around you to go along that journey with you, use some of the learning budget. You could set up a weekly session or bi-weekly, monthly, whatever you can get to practice some of the stuff together. But what tips do you have if you don't live in that world where other people already are bought into these practices?
It seems to me it's about technical leadership in the organization. And perhaps what needs to happen is that architects or the staff engineers or the technical leaders in your organization need to put some framework in place where this is actually kind of seen as expected or encouraged, and that will help your teammates to pay attention. There are some technical things that probably will also help, like making sure that there is a stage that's running unit tests in your delivery pipeline. So if you write unit tests, they have a place to go. And there is trunk-based development or a desire for continuous integration. That kind of needs to come as a policy from the top level. So if you're in an organization and your technical leadership is not encouraging these kinds of practices and your team is not interested, I think you're going to really struggle to lead it from where you are in a team. So in that situation, I would be tempted to look for a new job, really. There has to be a level of technical leadership in the organization to encourage this, I think.
I want to shift gears a little bit because I happen to know that ensemble programming is a practice that you employ quite a bit in your coaching. Maybe we can start with just like a definition of what is ensemble programming.
This is where you get a group of software developers together working on a piece of code where there's only one computer. Everyone is collaborating over the code that goes into that one computer. So Woody Zuhl initiated this approach, basically, and he wrote a book which is called Software Teaming. It's a collaboration technique for acknowledging that some software development is an intellectually difficult activity. You've got to make a host of decisions all the time about what code to write next, how to design the code, how to approach the problem, how to break it down. And if you're coding by yourself, that can very easily overload your brain with too many things to think about. So by collaborating with more minds attacking the same problem together, you can tackle a more difficult coding problem than you could tackle by yourself, or you can produce a better solution to a given coding problem than you could by yourself. An ensemble, you've got at least three people, maybe four, five, six people is a good size for an ensemble. And to get everyone to be able to collaborate, you need some kind of roles, you need some activities, you need to have communication patterns. So it's not just a kind of like you stick everyone in a room and say, go code. I teach a specific style of ensemble, which is called strong style, where you have a strict separation between the person who is typing the code into the computer and the person who is making the decisions about what code to write. So they are explaining in words so that the person typing knows what to write, but also so that everyone in the room can hear the description of what the intention is and what we're trying to do and what decisions we make and can contribute. Of course, you rotate the roles frequently as well so that everyone gets to take a turn at being the leader of the coding activities.
And what would you say ensemble is particularly good for?
Team building, sharing knowledge, picking up on new ways to do things. So when you start ensemble with a new group that you haven't met before, you just like, oh, you do it like that. Right. Oh, cool. I could do that. So there's a lot of kind of learning from one another. But then once you've been doing this for a while with the same group, you kind of all level up. Basically, you all become capable of doing what everyone else can do. And so it's a great way for raising skills. And you learn what everyone is capable of. So you get this kind of team building effect. And then even if you work separately afterwards, you understand one another better.
And so if you're in one of the former categories where you're starting one of the learning hours, would you recommend folks consider ensemble for that learning hour?
With a qualified yes, because I think there's a lot of things at once. Then the danger is that your brain can't actually learn all of those things at once. So it's a skill to be able to do ensemble. It takes some time and effort and practice and reflection and feedback to become good at being a good ensemble member. It also takes skill and attention to learn test-driven development and refactoring. And you can easily find yourself a little overwhelmed if you think, oh, in this 1 hour a week, we're going to learn all of those skills at the same time. So perhaps pace yourself a bit and start out with the ambition of perhaps doing some refactoring and maybe split into pairs for the exercise.
And is refactoring the engineering practice that you'd start with, if you could pick any to recommend a team start with?
Yeah, usually. Because I think there's a big win to be had just by learning your refactoring tools and what they're capable of. Most developers have got incredibly good refactoring tools in their IDE, but they have very little idea of what they're capable of and only scratch the surface of it. And I think you can become quite proficient with these tools fairly quickly once someone showed you what they can do and you've had a chance to practice with them a bit. So I think that can really make a difference quickly. And it's also the basis of one of the main parts of test-driven development, of course, is the refactoring step. And being able to do that well will put you on the road to be able to do TDD as well.
Okay, so learning refactoring certainly would be useful in your journey towards mastering test-driven development. Are there any other reasons why you think it might be worthwhile to develop the skill of refactoring? Like, why should anybody actually care?
I guess that there's the big elephant in the room here is the effect of AI coding assistants on code quality. They're kind of notorious for they produce a lot of code, but not all of it has the most fantastic design. My understanding is that basically the people who are using these tools most effectively are not just accepting whatever they get, they are improving the design of the code that the assistant is giving them. And so I think that's refactoring skills, that's object-oriented design skills. It's part of a package that makes you as a developer more effective in a modern world.
So what I'm hearing you say, I think, is that refactoring is a skill that's only going to increase in value over time as AI assistants become more and more pervasive. Am I hearing that right?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I mean, I made a video a while back, which I think has stood this test of time fairly well, in that pointing out that AI assistants have many strengths, but refactoring is not one of them. They are not a refactoring tool. A refactoring tool must be deterministic and reliable and work at the level of the abstract syntax tree of your code. So it's actually doing behavior-preserving transformations. Whereas your large language model coding assistant is not deterministic. It doesn't have access to the abstract syntax tree. At least I don't think the current generation does. And it doesn't always do behavior-preserving transformations. And that is where you need a deterministic tool, like the ones you've got in your IDE and you've had for years and underappreciated and undervalued and underused in most cases.
I think that's good advice. And I think it's helpful to put some of the stuff in context because, again, most of the stuff that we talked about today, for folks to find it interesting, it sort of assumes that folks are already interested inherently in learning these skills, but having a better understanding of why learning these skills can be impactful to them in their career, aside from just having general interest, I think is always a useful reality check.
Well, it's about code quality. This is the basis of being able to change code, the basis of agility, of being able to, you know, respond to change, respond to new requirements for your software. The basis of that is having a design that is flexible. And a flexible design is good quality code. It's also that it has tests, a unit test that provide a safety net as you change it. But at the fundamental level, the tests are not worth much if the design is too hard to understand. You can't change it because you don't understand it. So code quality is, I see it as a crucial enabler for everything else you want to do to be successful in your software organization. So, and code quality comes from good design decisions and skilled developers. And as my understanding of these newer coding assistants is that they are not very good at code quality a lot of the time. That is something that maybe they're getting better at, but you also have to be able to spot when they're not producing a design that's flexible and you need it. It's a really important skill for engineers to be able to write good quality code.
Yeah, I think that comment will stand the test of time as well, alongside the video that you shared earlier. I am wondering if there's any messages that you'd like to leave the audience with as we begin to wrap up our conversation.
You've got to think about your personal development and your skills and work with people who give you energy and that you are learning from. Whatever you're doing with software development, try and find a place where you've got those things that you can develop your skills and you're working in a context where people around you are supportive and you're learning stuff.
I think that's a great message. Well, with that, I just want to thank you, Emily, for being generous with your time and your perspective. It's always a pleasure chatting with you. If folks want to learn more about you or your work, where should they go?
I have a society, the Saman Society I mentioned earlier. We have a website, samancoaching.org. And on there, you can find activities that you can join and resources that you can use in your team learning sessions and things like that. So I'm all for promoting basically that you have team learning time, and we are trying to help you to set that up in a good way for happy coding. That's my kind of tagline, happy coding.
Awesome. Yeah. So we'll link to your YouTube channel where you talk about a lot of the things that we covered in today's conversation as well, including perhaps that specific video that you shared about refactoring and how it relates to working with AI coding assistants. But in any case, Emily, thank you again for making the time and being generous with your time and perspective. Hope to chat with you again soon.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us on Distributed. If you want to learn more about what we covered in this episode, or if you want to share your own thoughts, follow @TupleOnX or visit distributed.fm.